From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to Washington Watch. Coming up on this President's Day edition of Washington Watch.
We believe President Putin has made the decision, but until the tanks are actually rolling and the planes are flying, we will use every opportunity and every minute we have to see if diplomacy can still dissuade President Putin from carrying this forward.
That was Secretary of State Antony Blinken yesterday on CNN's State of the Union, commenting on the increasingly tense situation in Ukraine. We'll talk with Missouri Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler, a member of the House Armed Services Committee, also the Kansas City Star, running with a headline, quote, Hartzler launches transphobic ad targeting transgender college swimmer. What's that about? We'll talk about that as well with Vicki when she joins me in just a moment. And it's official.
And now I have to mark the end of this unforgettable Olympic experience. I declare the 24th Olympic Winter Games Beijing 2022 closed.
That was Thomas Bach, the president of the International Olympic Committee. The Winter Olympics 2022 are now over, but we are not finished. Today in our final Olympics 2022, Human Rights on Ice, was the Olympic stage what the Chinese Communist Party had hoped for? An opportunity to recast their international image. We'll get an answer from Asian expert and author Gordon Chang later on Washington Watch. Well, even as COVID infections decline and 70% of the public say it's time to accept COVID, that it's here to stay, and get on with life, President Biden announced he is extending the COVID national emergency that was set to expire the 1st of March. We'll check in with Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson, who has introduced legislation to give doctors, and not bureaucrats, the right to treat their patients. He joins us later with the details on Washington Watch. And it is shocking what is happening in Canada.
If you are involved in this protest, we will actively look to identify you and follow up with financial sanctions and criminal charges. Absolutely. This investigation will go on for months to come.
That was Interim Ottawa Police Chief Steve Bell over the weekend. We'll talk with Rachel Emanuel, a reporter for iPolitics, who was on Parliament Hill in Ottawa and witnessed the totalitarian tactics of the Trudeau regime. And finally, election reform. States are back at it with more election reform measures being introduced this year than last year, driving the left crazy. Jason Sneed, executive director of Honest Elections Project, provides us with an update from the states. The website, TonyPerkins.com. If you miss anything or you want to share it with your friends, it can all be found there at TonyPerkins.com. From today's Stand on the Word Bible reading plan, we have Exodus 31:6, which reads in part, I have put wisdom in the hearts of all the gifted artisans, that they may make all that I have commanded you, end quote. That was the Lord speaking to Moses about the building of the tabernacle. The skills of the craftsmen were given to them by God, and they were to be used to honor and glorify God. Every believer, no matter their profession, is to use their God-given skills to honor him. To find out more about the Bible reading plan, go to frc.org/Bible. Once again, I invite you to join me each morning, Monday through Friday, for a short devotional from the daily reading. You can join me on Facebook at Tony Perkins or at my website, TonyPerkins.com. All right, just a couple of hours ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin signed decrees recognizing Ukraine's breakaway region as part of Russian territory, a move to which U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken previously promised a swift and firm response. Secretary Blinken said the move would amount to Russian government's wholesale rejection of its earlier commitments. Based on what we've seen so far from the Biden administration, how might the U.S. respond? Well, joining me to talk about this and more is U.S. Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler. She is a member of the House Armed Services Committee. She represents the 4th Congressional District of Missouri. Congresswoman Hartzler, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Tony. It's good to be here.
All right. Can we get your thoughts on the latest developments in the Ukraine situation?
Oh, it's very serious and it's very heartbreaking. You know, this is a free and independent people, a democracy, and many of them are Christians. And the thought that you have a thug like Vladimir Putin that just wants to, through raw power, take this country is just absolutely heartbreaking. And the weakness of our own president has sadly, I think, only enabled this to take place after what President Biden did with the debacle of leaving Afghanistan. It just showed how weak we are. And this president has not negotiated in good faith with Putin from the beginning. He's acquiesced. And now we're at a doorstep of losing this nation and their freedom being squashed. It's truly a dark day.
Congresswoman Hartzler, the big divide between Republicans and Democrats in Congress over this issue, I mean, they're unified on the fact they want to help Ukraine, they want to support Ukraine. But the idea of sanctions, Republicans feel like the sanctions should be put in place now to deter any further action by Russian forces. But the Biden administration says, oh, you can only use them once, so we're going to wait until afterwards. What good will sanctions do after they invade?
Oh, it's ridiculous. It doesn't even make any sense. No, I believe they do need to be putting sanctions on them right now. You don't wait until perhaps tens of thousands of people are killed and missiles have been launched and airplanes attack and drop bombs and ships shoot off missiles and tanks invade your country and then put in sanctions. Now is the time to sanction them and to tell Putin, if you want these sanctions removed, then move your troops and your tanks and your airplanes away from the border. Then we can sit down and talk. That's what we should be doing right now.
Is this another example of the fallout of our withdrawal from Afghanistan, the implications of this showing weakness that, you know, our enemies just don't take us serious as a nation?
No, we are at a place, sadly, where our allies don't trust us and our enemies don't fear us because of the weak hand that President Biden has shown and this terrible debacle in Afghanistan. You know, we were working with other nations to try to bring freedom to the people of Afghanistan, to root out the terrorist strongholds there that were used to attack our nation on 9/11. And here, the president had no plan. He left over $90 billion of equipment there. He didn't get the Americans out. He left people his own country. He left the interpreters, and it was just mayhem. And because of that, Putin has only been emboldened. But there's been other mistakes that Biden has made. You know, the criminals that work at the behest of Putin took out through cyber attack the Colonial Pipeline earlier that shut down the whole energy on the East Coast. And what was the response of Biden? He says, well, I talked to Putin and he promised not to do it again. But if he crossed the line, if he gets some really, really bad things, then we're going to act. And then he talked to him about getting back in the INF treaty. He shut down our Keystone pipeline and then green lighted the Nord Stream 2 pipeline for Russia. So at every turn, he has acquiesced to Biden. He has shown weakness and Putin's taken advantage of it now. And there's going to be millions of people in Ukraine who are going to be hurt because of it.
Right. Unfortunately, many innocents will pay the price for that weakness. I want to switch gears, Congresswoman Hartzler. The Kansas City Star ran with a headline entitled Hartzler Launches Transphobic Ad Targeting Transgender College Swimmer. After you ran an ad last week, I want to play a short clip of that ad. Play clip number 4, please.
I'm Vicki Hartzler. I ran and coached girls track, and I won't look away while woke liberals destroy women's sports. Women's sports are for women, not men pretending to be women.
You know what? That seems pretty timely now, given that the Ivy League championships that took place over the weekend, where Leah Thomas, the transgender athlete in the ad, broke records and beat the competition. What's your reaction to Thomas's performance and to the Kansas City Star?
Oh, it is heartbreaking for the female athletes that have worked their entire life to be able to get to this spot where they are competing at the collegiate level. And then to have someone who is a male but believes that he's a female come in and compete on their same team and defeat them, take their medals, take their record-setting opportunities away. It's absolutely heartbreaking. And our country and the elite certainly just seem to have gone insane. They have just lacked basic common sense, and that girls' sports is supposed to be for girls, not for biological males who think they are girls. I mean, it's just common sense. And yet we are seeing this so that they are allowing more and more of these individuals to compete against girls' sports. The whole purpose of Title IX, which passed years ago, was to make sure that females had the opportunity to participate and succeed in sports. Sports meant a lot to me. Growing up, I played basketball and volleyball, and I ran track. I did have the opportunity to set some track records at Archie High School, my little hometown. But then I went on to coach track when I became a teacher. And I am so proud of these female athletes, and I will not be silenced by liberals who think that we should just acquiesce to this and sit by silently and let these transgendered athletes take our girls' first place medals and set the records. It's just wrong. And the Kansas City Star is clearly wrong. I believe that I'm speaking common sense, what most people in Missouri believe, and that girls' sports should be for girls.
It's, as you said, it's common sense. I was actually in the swimming pool this morning, swimming, and of course, I could put a two-piece bathing suit on. I still wouldn't be any better than I am. I'm just doing it to stay in shape. But the reality is this is an issue of fairness. I mean, common sense, yes, but fairness. We're depriving young girls of opportunities to do well. I mean, we know, all right, we know men are biologically different than women. Doesn't mean they're superior. It just means they're different, they're stronger, and they have the ability to compete in athletics with an advantage. That's why we have women's sports, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. And we had, there were 16 girls on the same team as Leah Thomas, who sent a letter protesting his ability to compete against them and asking the Ivy League to not recognize them, because in the letter they point out that he transitioned after his puberty, and so they point out that he has greater muscle capacity, greater height, greater strength with his arms and the ability to reach out further. And he also has greater lung capacity. Those things are critical components to be able to perform while you're swimming. And it is unfair to allow him to compete against the females who have worked for their whole life for this opportunity. It is about fairness. And this is about feminism, too. I have been proud of some of the liberal feminists who are speaking up now. We're finding common ground that this is wrong. Women's rights, you know, should prevail in this case. And every woman, no matter your political affiliation, should be standing up for these girls on these sports teams.
Well, Congresswoman Hartzler, I appreciate your courage to stand up and face the laugh that, you know, they deny reality and they want to attack anyone who says, look, this is common sense, shouldn't be happening. Thank you for speaking up, and thanks for being on the program today. Always good to see you.
You too. Thanks, Tony.
All right, coming up, we're going to wrap up our Human Rights on Ice series and speak with China expert Gordon Chang on the other side of the break. So don't go away. A lot more Washington Watch to come on this President's Day edition.
Are you struggling to spend consistent time in God's Word? Then join Family Research Council on an exciting journey through the Bible. FRC's two-year Bible reading plan helps you to approach daily Bible reading with an intentional focus of diving deeper into the nature of God and how His Word speaks into cultural issues. By studying the Bible, we can see the grandeur of God unfold throughout the past. The Stand on the Word reading plan takes you through daily scripture in an engaging manner to help you stay grounded in God's truth. All wisdom comes from God, and He has given us the Bible as a way to understand the world. Start this adventure today with Family Research Council. When you sign up, we'll text you every Sunday with daily passages and questions that help prepare you for conversations with your friends and family. To begin this journey, visit frc.org/Bible. With the current division and confusion of our culture, it is so important for Christians to root ourselves in the truth of God's Word so that we are prepared to give a reason for the hope that we have. For this purpose, Family Research Council launched the Center for Biblical Worldview. The center applies the Bible and the historical teachings of the church to current issues. This helps Christians understand and live by a biblical worldview, know why Scripture must be authoritative, and equips believers to advance and defend the faith in workplaces, schools, communities, and the public square. The experts at the center address and provide resources on issues like religious liberty, abortion, voting, marriage, and sexuality. To access free resources like the Biblical Worldview series, go to frc.org/worldview. To get highlights of the latest work of the Worldview Fellows, including blogs, interviews, and publications, sign up at frc.org/subscriptions. At Family Research Council, it is important to us that we stay connected with you and that you stay informed. With the increase in tech censorship of conservatives and Christians, we've decided to be proactive to make sure we don't go completely dark due to censorship. That is why we've created a tech subscription platform. If we get canceled, you can stay informed and still find updates on faith, family, and freedom. How? Just text STAND to 67742 to sign up for our text alerts, and you will get FRC's content straight to your phone. Again, just text STAND to 67742, and you will get special alerts on the biggest stories of the day. You can stay informed with just a simple text. We want you to be able to stay connected with like-minded community and to always have access to our content. Stay connected and informed. Just text STAND to 67742.
Beijing 2022, human rights on ice.
The 2022 Winter Olympics in Beijing have officially concluded. During yesterday's closing ceremony, the president of the International Olympic Committee, Thomas Bach, lavished praise on China, saying that they had, quote, set the stage in such an excellent way, and using words like outstanding and magnificent, ordinary, extraordinary, and truly exceptional to describe what the Chinese Communist Party put together. But my next guest will probably have some other adjectives to describe the handiwork of the CCP. Joining me now to wrap up our special Human Rights on Ice series is China expert Gordon Chang, author of The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. He can be found on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Gordon, welcome back to the program.
Thank you so much, Tony. And the word that went through my mind, that adjective, was despicable.
Well, let's talk about that, because what the Chinese Communist Party had hoped was, as Mr. Bach had described, hoping that the world would see China in such a way. They had the international stage for nearly 2 weeks. Did the Communist Party of China succeed in whitewashing their image?
Maybe internally, but certainly not externally, because what they did, Tony, was to give a bigger platform to the critics of China. It gave people the opportunity to talk about genocide, atrocities, crimes against humanity, talked about totalitarian social controls at home. This was really a scene actually for people to talk about China in a realistic way. So no, externally, this was a debacle for Beijing.
Nothing like what we saw back in 2008 when they had the Summer Olympics. Of course, it's a different country now. They've been able to basically lock ranks, and their grip that the Communist Party has on the Chinese people is much stronger. But I think you're absolutely right. I know you were busy over the last couple of weeks, and most human rights experts as well, speaking out using this platform. Is this reflective in the lackluster numbers of viewers for the Beijing Olympics?
Tony, I'm really stunned by that, because I thought that the Olympics in China, with all of these issues surrounding it, would have meant record viewership on NBC. But that obviously was not the case. There was a record, but it was record low. So I'm really surprised about that. You know, it's one of those things where, to borrow something, a word from another religion, I actually do believe there's karma in the world, and NBC suffered it.
Well, they certainly didn't use their platform to draw attention to the abuses of the Communist Party there in China. But let's talk about corporate America. What do you think has been the coming out of corporate America through the Olympics? What messages are they sending?
Well, they sent two messages. I mean, internally, they actually, companies like Coca-Cola inside China were actually heavily promoting their sponsorship of the Olympics. But externally, they were silent. And I think that's a real indication that these companies knew that what they were doing was wrong, that what they were doing was complicit in these crimes against humanity. And so they did not want to highlight their role as backing the Olympics and therefore backing China and therefore backing what China has been doing against Uyghurs, Tibetans, and other minorities.
You know, Gordon, public awareness, public sentiment reaches a tipping point when there are those that continually speak about these issues. And it would be clear to me, of course, I'm very close to it, so maybe I'm a little biased, but it appears to me that there is a growing momentum in terms of the concern that the international community is showing regarding what is happening in China, not only to the Uyghurs, to the Falun Gong, to the Tibetans, and to the house Christians that are also being targeted by the Chinese Communist Party. Are we nearing a tipping point in terms of the international outcry against China?
I actually think that we are. And part of it, Tony, is not just that there's been an accumulation of news about China, but during these Olympics, China actually highlighted its role against Uyghurs, against India, against, for instance, health. They highlighted their role in spreading COVID-19 beyond China by having Director General Tedros of the World Health Organization be one of the torchbearers. So I think that essentially Beijing is now so arrogant that it wants to rub this in our faces that it's trying to intimidate us, and that is creating the tipping point that you're talking about.
And so I would think that because, you know, we really can't touch the Communist Party of China, but all of those who are complicit in their agenda and in their abuse of human rights, corporate America, the political class, Hollywood, and others who are aiding and abetting the Communist Party, I would think that they are vulnerable.
They are vulnerable because what they have done is they've mortgaged their future and put it into the hands of a regime. That regime is going to do things that has already done things, of course, that Americans abhor. And that means that NBA, Hollywood, Walmart, all of these big institutions and companies now have been identified and have placed their future in the hands of people they can't control and people who are monsters.
And so still, the American people who care about basic human rights, especially, I would say, to our audience, Christians who do not want to see other people persecuted for their religious beliefs, one of the things you do is you stop buying products from China that, in some cases, are made, at least in the supply chain, slave labor or forced labor used in those products. I mean, we can make a difference by the way we spend our money.
Absolutely. With our everyday purchasing decisions, we can strike a blow for freedom and democracy and for freedom of religion and for all the things that we believe in. We can also make that decision with our investments, not investing in China. Telling our investment managers, no, don't put your money in stocks X, Y, and Z. And we can do a number of small things. Each of us, you know, there's just so many of us. There's more of us than them. And collectively, we do wield great power.
Yes. And it's important that we teach corporate America a lesson. And I know they're motivated by money. And so we get their attention and maybe keep them focused more on the straight and narrow. No promises, but we can do our best. Gordon Chang, always great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us on our final segment of Human Rights on Ice.
Thank you so much, Tony.
All right, folks, stick around. More Washington Watch to come. President Biden has announced that he is continuing the national emergency that was declared back in March 2020. We'll be talking to Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. Don't go away.
What is religious liberty and why should you care about it? Simply put, religious liberty is the freedom to choose your religious beliefs and to live according to those beliefs. Why should we care about this freedom? At Family Research Council, we care about religious freedom because we believe that it is an inherent human right that all governments have an obligation to protect. Tragically, not all governments do. Religious persecution is a tragic reality around the world that is not often acknowledged by the media, even though attacks on people of all faiths continue to increase globally. In Scripture, God calls Christians to pray and care for the persecuted church, the downtrodden, and those who cannot help themselves. Therefore, we must be advocates for those persecuted for their faith. To access Family Research Council's latest resources and to learn more about religious freedom and what you can do to help the persecuted, go to frc.org/religious liberty.
Do you want to be able to stay up to date on conservative news? Are you looking for Christian resources to help you stay politically engaged? Then download Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. With all of our content available at your fingertips, you will conveniently be able to stay up to date throughout your busy day. The Stand Firm app will give you access to a variety of resources, such as our most recent episodes of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, tweets and other social media posts, and our latest blogs, updates, and publications. Additionally, you will have the opportunity to take action and make your voice heard by contacting your elected officials on the issues that most concern you. Visit the App Store on your smartphone or mobile device and search Stand Firm to download Family Research Council's official Stand Firm app.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Tony Perkins, your host. The website, tonyperkins.com. Check it out. On Friday, President Biden announced that he is continuing the national emergency that was declared by former President Trump back on March 13, 2020. Now, regarding this is all about the coronavirus. Now, this is despite the fact that, look, infection rates are down. 70% of the American public says, look, it's time just to decide we got to live with this and let's go on with life. And many, even blue state Democratic leaders are saying enough of this. We've got to move on. Well, in his notice, he stated the COVID-19 pandemic continues to cause significant risk to the public, to the health and safety of the nation. But are we really in a similar position to where we were back in March 2020 when COVID-19 was new and there was no vaccine and we didn't know how to treat it? Joining me now to discuss this and more is U.S. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, who is a member of the Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee and a member of the Commerce, Science and Transportation Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the program.
Hello, Tony. Great to be back.
All right, so what's your response to the president continuing this national emergency declaration?
I don't understand why he's doing it. Again, you go back 2 years, there's so much we didn't know about the coronavirus, COVID, the disease, but we've learned an awful lot. There's still a lot we don't know, but we've learned an awful lot. And I think one of the things we've learned is this isn't going to go away. So does the president expect to keep America in a perpetual state of emergency, a perpetual state of fear? I think the biggest blunder of our response to COVID was the fact that we did not robustly explore early treatment. I talked to doctors that successfully treat patients, so they've been doing so for the last 2 years. They've been saving lives. And yet our healthcare agencies, I call them now the COVID cartel, the administration, the agencies, big pharma, the legacy media, big tech social media giants, the COVID cartel has prevented and sabotaged early treatment. And I personally agree with doctors who said it cost hundreds of thousands of people their lives.
Yeah, that's one of the things we've learned in this process, that we've had bureaucrats step in between a doctor and patient. And so based on that, you've actually introduced legislation, the Right to Treat Act, which says if a drug has been approved by the FDA, then a physician, based upon his knowledge of his patient, should be the one to determine what treatment that patient receives, not some bureaucrat in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, this piece of legislation should not have been required. I champion Right to Try, which was all about giving people the freedom to use a drug that is not fully FDA approved. This just basically codifies what is already should be the reality is that if there's a fully FDA approved drug, doctors have the right to prescribe that off label, which, by the way, 20-25% of all prescriptions are prescribed off label. They're prescribed for a condition other than the one that they're originally approved to be used for. The other thing my piece of legislation does is says the federal government should not interfere and should not regulate the practice of medicine. That is up to doctors. Doctors ought to be at the top of the medical treatment pyramid. Right now, because of COVID, they're at the very bottom, and they're being crushed, and patients are being crushed.
Senator, isn't that a part of practicing medicine? Isn't that how we perfect the process, where we allow doctors who are treating particular diseases or ailments, that we allow them to treat, not someone who is sitting back behind some desk in Washington, D.C., calling the shots for, I have to say, for political reasons?
Yeah, if I'm going to go get treated for an illness, I'm going to go to a doctor that actually has the courage and compassion to treat an illness, not some bureaucrats, not some academician in an ivory tower. You know, the term practicing medicine really hit home to me when we had our first daughter who had a very serious congenital heart defect. Her life was saved by doctors practicing medicine. The procedure they performed on her, rebaffling the upper chamber of her heart, they've now advanced that to where they do the atrial switch, which was about a 50% mortality back there 38 years ago. So I'm personally affected by the practice of medicine of doctors who dedicate their lives to saving other lives, being at the top of the medical treatment chain, not at the very bottom.
Well, again, speaking of things that we now know that we didn't know 2 years ago, according to a new study in the Journal of the American Medical Association, Pfizer's COVID-19 shot is associated with 133 times greater risk of heart inflammation for teenage boys. Isn't this something we should be concerned about, especially when we're mandating these vaccines for so many people?
I've been concerned about what the CDC's own safety surveillance system, its early warning system, has been flashing for months. Back when it was like 3,000 deaths reported on VAERS. Now we're up to 23,990 deaths reported on VAERS, 1.1 million adverse events. And the CDC, the FDA, NIH just shrugging it off like, oh, there's nothing to see here. Again, I realize VAERS doesn't prove causation, but 30% of those deaths have occurred on days 0, 1, and 2 following vaccination. It's certainly something I think they ought to be exploring, something I'm concerned about.
Well, Senator Johnson, I appreciate the fact that you, despite the criticism you've come under, continue to draw attention to this with the experts. It's not commentary. You're bringing the experts in to testify on a number of occasions, and we're grateful for that. And thanks for coming on today as well.
Stay well.
All right. Senator Ron Johnson of Wisconsin. You know, there is no other explanation for this. We have never treated another disease, another illness, another virus like this. They're not following the science. It really is about power and control. And speaking of that, coming up, Canadian authorities over the weekend moved to squash the Freedom Convoy demonstrations in Ottawa. And they're vowing to chase down anyone who was there. Have they gone too far? We'll get an eyewitness report from a journalist who was on the ground there. Coming up after the break, don't go away. More Washington Watch to come.
Do you want to be able to stay up to date on conservative news? Are you looking for Christian resources to help you stay politically engaged? Then download Family Research Council's Stand Firm app. With all of our content available at your fingertips, you will conveniently be able to stay up to date throughout your busy day. The Stand Firm app will give you access to a variety of resources, such as our most recent episodes of Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, tweets and other social media posts, and our latest blogs, updates, and publications. Additionally, you will have the opportunity to take action and make your voice heard by contacting your elected officials on the issues that most concern you. Visit the App Store on your smartphone or mobile device and search Stand Firm to download Family Research Council's official Stand Firm app.
What is religious liberty and why should you care about it? Simply put, religious liberty is the freedom to choose your religious beliefs and to live according to those beliefs. Why should we care about this freedom? At Family Research Council, we care about religious freedom because we believe that it is an inherent human right that all governments have an obligation to protect. Tragically, not all governments do. Religious persecution is a tragic reality around the world that is not often acknowledged by the media, even though attacks on people of all faiths continue to increase globally. In Scripture, God calls Christians to pray and care for the persecuted church, the downtrodden, and those who cannot help themselves. Therefore, we must be advocates for those persecuted for their faith. To access Family Research Council's latest resources and to learn more about religious freedom and what you can do to help the persecuted, go to frc.org/religious liberty.
Attention university students. Are you looking for an internship that will help you grow as a Christian leader and allow you to positively influence the culture? Then Family Research Council's internship program is for you. FRC's life-changing 12 to 15-week internship program will prepare and equip you for the next step in your professional journey. You'll enjoy a speaker series focusing on careers and callings, lectures from prominent conservative leaders, and weekly biblical worldview training. All of these offerings were created to aid you in your personal and professional development. As an intern, you will have the opportunity to work side by side with our experts in policy, communications, event planning, and more. The real-world experience you gain will prepare you to pursue a career of influence and make a difference wherever God calls you. This paid internship offers fully funded housing in the heart of downtown DC, giving you the chance to experience our nation's capital. Visit frc.org/internships to apply.
You are listening to Washington Watch, and I'm Tony Perkins, your host. So good to have you with us. On Friday, Ottawa police began moving in on demonstrators who had been out there on Canada's Parliament Hill to protest the government's overreach and their COVID mandates. And by Sunday, the police had a firm grasp over the area. Here with me now to tell us what took place on the ground is Rachel Emanuel. She's a reporter for the Canadian digital newspaper iPolitics. Rachel, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you for having me.
All right, can you just describe what you witnessed firsthand as you were there on Parliament Hill?
Sure. So as you mentioned, it began on Friday. Actually, well, on Monday, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked the Emergencies Act, which was going to give the police more powers to address the protesters. All levels of government had been asking them to leave for, 3 weeks, and they showed no signs of leaving. So the government decided to forcibly remove them. So I would say the city of Ottawa was kind of holding its breath in anticipation since Monday, waiting for police action. We knew that police action was going to be coming, and we could see it sort of escalating with just the number of police that were coming into the city. I remember specifically on Thursday and Friday, a lot of us here in media expected maybe there to be some action in the middle of the night. We kind of thought that would make sense just because there was, generally speaking, less protesters in the city in the middle of the night. I think that's fairly obvious. And it was just a bit quieter. But no, the police actually did waited until Friday midday to move. So what happened is I was kind of walking along Parliament Hill on Friday morning at around 11 a.m. And there was one structure there. It was a stage. And typically throughout the week, since the protesters arrived 3 weeks ago, there was always music playing from the stage. A lot of times there were speakers. They even had some live bands at times and people would be dancing. And that structure was directly in front of our Peace Tower, which is on our traditional House of Commons, which is currently under construction and it's not being used. So around 11 a.m., there's people speaking, there's people dancing. And all of a sudden one of the speakers says, there is a police force coming up from the east, but I want everyone to know that we're here legally and I want everyone to just remain calm. So people kind of knew the police were going to be coming at that point. So I walked down a little further east to where the police had been kind of coming up towards the hill. And what you saw there was you had a wall of police officers and they were all lined up so that no one could kind of get in and out behind them. And they were just walking forward, pushing protesters up as they walked up towards the hill. And anyone who stood in their way was just pushed. The police did not stop. They, at the same time, would all agree to move forward and they would walk about 5 to 8 feet every single time. And as I mentioned, for protesters that did not move, they were pushed. The police continued to walk forward. And they continued that throughout the day on Friday. They did not get very far at all. I was shocked. I left for a couple hours and I came back and they had hardly made any progress. And then this was around, I want to say 5:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. They were now in front of the Chateau Laurier, which is just a very famous hotel here in Ottawa, and the Senate building of Canada. And when I mentioned earlier in the day, they had been actually on the corner of the Senate building. So they had come around the corner and up to the front of the Senate building, and the whole from like noon till 5:30 p.m. That was all the progress that they had made. And it was at this time that you saw a lot of the videos of horses coming through the crowd, and some two individuals got trampled, actually. Sorry, it looks like you want to jump in there with a question, so I'll give you a sec.
Well, let me just ask you, I know you had a lot of interaction with the demonstrators. What has that been like? Were the demonstrators, I mean, were they resisting the police, or are they just there kind of making a statement, as you said, that they had a right to be there and they were just exercising that right?
Certainly. So it was a bit of a mix. You had a lot of demonstrators who definitely did not want to get caught in the police and, you know, get caught in the pushing and the action there. And so they were making it known that they were there and they felt that they had a right to be there. And so when the police came towards them, they backed up. And then you had other demonstrators who tried to resist moving back, and they would sort of keep themselves planted when police did push forward, and sort of try to stand there, maybe shove back a little bit. And then you had others in the crowd who were saying, be peaceful, don't fight with the officers. So there was a fair mix of things, but I didn't see much violence from the demonstrators. They, at most, from what I witnessed firsthand, and obviously I was not everywhere at once, the most I saw was them trying not to move by just resisting the police when they did push forward.
So prior to the police coming on to the scene Friday and Saturday and over the weekend, did you see any other violent behavior among the demonstrators that have been there for a couple of weeks?
Sure. So this has been something that has been talked about quite a bit. And on one side of the coin, you have people who are living in the city of Ottawa who say that they have felt very unsafe here and they have felt very threatened since the protesters arrived towards the end of January. I did not witness any violence in my encounters with the protesters. I frequently walk around Parliament Hill. I live very close to the area. One of the issues that I heard was a lot of people in Ottawa like to wear their masks outside just for COVID reasons. And also in Ottawa, it is extremely cold here. It's between negative 20 and negative 30, probably about negative 4 degrees Fahrenheit, if I have that correct. So it is quite cold. Some people like to just wear masks when they walk outside because of even the winter weather being so chilly. And I definitely heard reports of people being harassed wearing masks on the street. At one occasion, I was leaving the house of the West Block, which is one of our Parliament buildings. And I did see a woman walking around with a loudspeaker on, yelling at people through the loudspeaker to take their masks off. But it was just sort of like those verbal, I guess, harassment, if you could describe it as that, that I witnessed firsthand. I didn't see the protesters engage in any violence towards any residents of the city of Ottawa at any point.
Rachel, final question for you, based upon what you've observed there for the last few weeks. What's next?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think it's sort of what everyone is wondering. On one hand, we have the protesters who are extremely upset. They feel that they had a right to be protesting in the city of Ottawa. And for many of them, they've lost their businesses. And this was sort of the one thing that they had left to do, I guess, to sort of take action and call on the government. We know that some of the truck convoys are still parked outside of the city of Ottawa, about 40 minutes. I did just speak to some of the truckers yesterday, and they told me they think they might do a convoy back home just to sort of be like one last hurrah for their movement. I'm hearing other talks that maybe there will still be demonstrations in Ottawa on the weekends. It's hard to say what's next. We know that the federal government has invoked the Emergencies Act, and they haven't relinquished those powers despite the protesters now being removed from the city of Ottawa. And they're doing that, they say, because they believe there is still a threat that protesters could return. So at this point, it seems unlikely that protesters are going to be able to come to the city of Ottawa, which is still under police lockdown. There's still quite a few police checkpoints that you have to go through to even access the downtown core and even to get off the highway. So, I mean, for the people who came here because they wanted to have themselves heard, I don't know what's next for them. We do know that the government is also going to be following protesters who were involved, and they said that anyone who was involved with the protest can expect charges and repercussions for that.
Well, amazing. We'll continue to watch that because it certainly sparked other efforts in other parts of the world, including here in the United States. Rachel, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey, folks. Wow, amazing. I mean, this is, unfortunately, I think, a foretaste of things to come. We see this even in our own country. I mean, Washington, D.C., for the last 2 years has been pretty much in lockdown. But since January the 6th, the Capitol, you know, the People's House, it takes an act of Congress to get in there. It takes an act of Nancy Pelosi anytime you go in there to get approval to go in. Look, I'm grateful for the truckers in Canada and all that I saw, and I'm sure there's always one or two that's going to do things that others would not. This was, for the most part, as you heard from Rachel, a non-violent demonstration. Nothing like what we saw with Black Lives Matter or Antifa that was burning cities during the summer of 2020. But we see this strong hand of government. Of course, we're talking about Canada, but I'm concerned about Biden even extending the state of emergency for coronavirus. Now, I know that's not the same. I don't want to mix policies, but it does allow them to continue to mandate and control us with these COVID mandates. And this is what's behind all of this. So I'm grateful that we've got some convoys going here in the United States. We're going to be tracking that this week. So we're going to be following that as that develops here in the United States. Something else I want to follow that's developing is there has been a lot of activity in state legislatures to ensure the integrity of our elections. After 2020, a lot of people concerned. And I told you, I said, look, you've got to get busy. You've got to talk to your state legislators. And they have to correct the issues that came to the forefront during this election so that you will not disengage in terms of voting. Well, here to tell us what he's been tracking and what we might expect going into the 2022 midterm elections and even the 2024 presidential election is Jason Sneed, Executive Director of the Honest Elections Project. Jason, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So, Jason, last year, a lot of election reform measures that went through state legislatures, I think, if I'm not mistaken, 19 states, somewhere in that neighborhood. But we're seeing even more this year. Tell us about it.
Well, that's right. And this is actually quite unusual for someone who has been tracking these issues for a long time to see so much energy back to back, you know, year after year. I think it's actually something that's been long overdue, and I hope that we'll continue to see it. But this year, there are actually, if you can believe it, over 2,300 bills pending in legislatures across the country. Some of them carried over from last year, some new measures, all designed to do various things to improve the election process, at least some of them coming from the right. One of the big issues that we've been tracking is the ways in which states are improving the security for absentee and mail-in ballots. So making that mail-in balloting process work better, work more transparently, doing things like bringing voter identification requirements, which are very common sense and very popular in in-person voting, bringing those to mail-in voting as well. We're also seeing a tremendous amount of energy being put into cleaning up voter rolls and developing policies to keep them clean on an ongoing basis, which actually dovetails quite nicely with improving the mail-in voting process, because after all, you don't want to mail ballots to people who aren't eligible to vote in your jurisdiction or may in fact be dead. So that's a vital improvement to the process. We're talking about improving the voter registration process as well, tackling litigation and ending private funding and a whole host of other measures I'd be happy to get into.
Well, Jason, it's encouraging. I think voters should be encouraged. Those that were concerned about their ballot not being counted or somehow, being dismissed in this last election or, eclipsed by illegal voting. This is good news that the state legislators, state leaders have taken this on so seriously. Now, this, of course, has evoked the wrath of the left. That's why we see Congress and the Democrats trying to push this federal takeover of elections. But tell our viewers and our listeners some of the things in some of the states where these things are moving right now, where they can actually be a part of helping push this across the line.
Well, that's absolutely right. The number one goal here is to improve our election system to make it easier to vote and harder to cheat so that we're bolstering voter confidence. And a big part of this is indeed getting individuals who are, after all, voters involved in this process. And there's a number of states where we're actually tracking legislation right now. Some of them are big states like Arizona, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Michigan, Wisconsin. And when I say big states, I mean, these are big states in terms of national politics, right? These are the swing states that everyone watches closely and engages in presidential years. Some of these states are going to have very competitive Senate races this year. So there's a lot of attention being focused into these states. There's also a lot of effort being put into them in their state legislatures to get these improvements done ahead of the next round of elections. In Florida, for instance, there is a measure which is moving through the legislature right now, which would do something which is not quite unique, but almost so. It would create an investigatory bureau within the state government to actually investigate instances of alleged election crimes. And this is so important because one of the things that we know is that too often allegations of wrongdoing go uninvestigated. We know that prosecutors devote resources to many other areas besides election law. So this is a potentially good step to make sure that we are at the very least investigating and getting answers as to whether allegations of fraud or wrongdoing are accurate, and then hopefully getting prosecutions if there is fraud. And then there are other measures proceeding through the states as well. In Arizona, they're going to be improving the early voter list there. There's a measure that's moving through the legislature to end same-day registration and a number of other provisions. And of course, in Michigan right now, there's a signature gathering process going forward called Secure My Vote, where if they actually get the requisite number of signatures, this petition goes straight to the legislature and can be enacted, which would adopt a number of, I think, improvements to state law, including bringing voter ID to absentee ballots.
So Jason, not only does this give voters greater confidence going forward in terms of the election, but it pushes back on the narrative of the left in Washington, D.C. here, where they're wanting to say, oh, we've got to make sure we have elections that everybody's vote counts. I mean, the states are doing what the states should do, and this is evidence of that. And it's, again, it's quite encouraging to me.
Oh, it's very encouraging. I think that we should see this level of engagement every single year. You know, we have an election at least every 2 years in this country, and we always learn lessons. And so I think it is incumbent upon our state lawmakers to look at the last election, to see where there were failures, to see where there were problems, and then to identify solutions and adopt them. And, you know, very much we want to see this at the state level, not at the federal level, but at the state level. That's right. Where the founders wanted to put this power. And there's so much benefit that comes from this. States can experiment, see what works, right, and replicate success while avoiding failures. And so I'm very, very glad to see this level of energy being devoted to this issue. It's so vitally important. And one thing that you brought up, the left is always saying that we need to make voting effortless. That's really what they want. They want voting to be effortless. They want to get rid of the basic safeguards that secure the process and give meaning to our vote and allow us to have confidence that election results are actually the results that reflect the will of the people. And so, you know, my counter to that is quite simple. You know, the best way to get people to vote is to show them that their ballots have meaning. Right. The left says we need to make it effortless. I say we need to make it easy to vote, but also hard to cheat so that you know very your good ballot counts.
Jason, we're out of time. Very quickly, where can folks find out more about the states you're tracking?
Go to our website, honestelections.org, or follow us on Twitter and Facebook. We're posting a lot of up-to-date information on both of those platforms.
Very good. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And folks, thank you for joining us as well. And I leave you once again with encouraging words of the Apostle Paul. It says, when you've done everything you can do, when you've prayed, when you've prepared, and when you've taken your stand, by all means, keep standing.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is brought to you by Family Research Council and is entirely listener supported. Portions of the show discussing candidates are brought to you by Family Research Council Action. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.